Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk, and then there were 21 Democrats running for president. Three Democratic candidates have dropped out of the race in the past couple weeks, and if you recall, dear listeners, we had music for when candidates got in the race, so here is our dropout music.
Little on the nose.
Wait, was that always our dropout music?
We haven't had dropout music yet. Representative Seth Moulton and Governors Jay Inslee and John Hickenlooper are out of the race. So today we're going to discuss what the early dropouts teach us about the Democratic Party and how the field may winnow going forward. Also, economic growth is slowing globally, and we don't know what the future will look like in the U.S., but we're going to debate how it would affect President Trump's standing if the U.S. economy were to sour. Here with me to do all of that, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. How's it going, Nate?
Great, Galen.
Happy Monday.
Blissful Monday. Blissful.
Blissful?
Blissful. Blissful.
Also with us, senior politics writer Claire Malone. How are you?
I'm good, Galen.
Blessful Monday?
Somewhere less than that, but still okay.
And managing editor Micah Cohen. How are you?
Very nice.
Cursed Monday?
A cursed Monday. Actually, I published Nate's story this morning accidentally with my byline. Did anybody notice that?
I did not.
I fixed it very quickly. But some of the aggregators now have my byline next to your
article. It's a pretty good story.
Well, I would have done it a little differently.
Okay.
Anyway, let's begin with the candidates who have dropped out of the Democratic primary race. So Governor of Washington, Jay Inslee, is instead going to seek a third term as governor. Former governor of Colorado, John Hickenlooper, is going to run for Senate in Colorado. And then Representative Seth Moulton from Massachusetts is going to run for re-election to Congress. Let's start kind of big picture. What does the group of candidates who dropped out of the race teach us about the Democratic Party? Because in some sense, being a swing state governor like John Hickenlooper or being the governor of a decent sized state and running on an issue that Democrats care a lot about, like climate change in the case of Jay Inslee, would have in past elections been pretty decent qualifiers for running for president. Why not this time? Why were those among the first people to drop out, Claire?
Well, I think to start with, they are people who didn't have much national name recognition. And I think that there is a desire among the Democrats to have someone who is a well-known figure run against Trump, because obviously Trump has quite a bit of celebrity, quite a bit of renown, and people don't want to have to spend a lot of their time introducing a candidate, even if they might be a conventionally worthy candidate, which I would say the governors are. I mean, you have executive experience. I think, honestly, Democrats are probably looking at a poor debate, losing someone like Inslee, who was focusing his entire campaign on a really big issue, a meaty issue. I have other thoughts about why the different like flavors of candidates all kind of got into the race. But I think what we're looking at for the top tier of contenders are people who have been known nationally for quite a few years. I mean, the Senate is seeing the prominent candidates are mostly products of the Senate. Mm-hmm. Not all, right? Except for Buttigieg, who's kind of like sliding a little bit in the...
Well, Biden was at one point in the Senate.
He was in the Senate, yeah.
But of course, is coming off of his vice presidency.
Yeah, I think it also shows the extent... I mean, one, just to put a fine point on what Claire said, the extent to which just getting oxygen is the main and maybe only thing that matters now is really striking, where you have these candidates who have dropped out, and a lot of them kind of came and went without really making a ripple in the national political pond, right? I don't know if that's a function of just Trump and modern politics or just having such a huge field, but like it's striking to me that a lot of these candidates just never got oxygen.
I mean, but what if the answer is just that these candidates suck?
Well, that might be it.
Although I think you have to differentiate that.
But then back that up if you think it's because they suck.
I mean, shouldn't that be the default? Most candidates suck.
If there were like...
I don't know. Give us more data than that.
If there were like eight candidates and two of them sort of just never made a ripple and dropped out, I'd be like, yeah, they didn't run good campaigns.
Yeah, but there's so many candidates.
Okay, let's leave Inslee aside for a moment. What rationale did Hickenlooper have for why he should be president?
Swing state governor. Businessman. Oh. Moderate.
Okay.
Yeah,
you answer the question.
Well, I mean, like, so, but he also was not very effective in the debate. He's not a super great communicator. He has kind of a quirky style that's a little John Kasich-like, I think. Maybe goes over well in, like, microbreweries in Colorado, but I think didn't translate very well to the national level.
But you're saying that the other people who are still in the race, who are maybe not catching on fire, are better communicators? Or Hickenlooper just had a more realistic...
I think most of the candidates aren't very relevant. And I think, like, the fact is, so maybe a flip, maybe a nice way to put this. There are some strong candidates in the Democratic field this year.
Yes.
The number two runner-up from last time, number one runner-up, Bernie Sanders, is running again. He has a very formidable brand. The former Vice President, Joe Biden, is running. Elizabeth Warren, who's maybe the biggest brand in the Democratic Party after those two, is running and has run, I think, a good campaign, yeah. Right? Kamala Harris, who has the profile also of a emerging leader in the party and blends different coalitions together pretty well, is a strong candidate. And Mayor Pete did actually kind of emerge from this muck.
But what about the people who are not the top tier people? I guess I'm more interested in your analysis of that. Like, are those people poor campaigners, people not able to get oxygen?
But your point is they're crowded, the top tier is crowding them out.
I think Moulton and Hickenlooper were shitty candidates. I don't think they did a very good job of articulating a clear message in their campaigns. I think Moulton is underqualified, being just a couple of terms in office from the House. Hickenlooper is more interesting, but I think underperformed. Inslee is the one where you might ask more questions.
Yeah, right? So explain that. What's the rationale for why Inslee dropped out at this point in the race?
Because Democrats don't care that much about climate change.
Do you really think that's the answer?
Yes, it's a straightforward answer. And people are trying to spin it in too many other ways. And meanwhile, you have people saying, oh, it's actually good that he kind of elevated the importance of climate change. Meanwhile, I know all the mechanics, but the DNC this weekend was trying to quash the idea of having a climate change focused forum. So that's a big FU to climate, frankly.
So here's a question. Of the people, you know, the people who have made the debate stage, who are maybe doing less well in the polls, Booker, Castro, Klobuchar, O'Rourke, Yang.
I mean, those are also relative. You know, why isn't Booker or Klobuchar doing better, or Castro? Because they do have interesting credentials and, I think, more distinctive brands and messages, and they're also at 1% or 2%. But, you know, 1% or 2% or 3% or 4% is a lot better than 0.1%. Or I think Moulton literally did not get above 0, literally did not get to 1% in any single poll that was used for debate qualifying.
No, and I agree with that. I guess my point, though, is like, okay, Moulton's an easy one. I think Inslee, as you say, is a little bit harder. I agree with your interpretation that Democratic voters clearly are not prioritizing climate change, at least relative to other stuff. But some of these candidates like Bullock or even Klobuchar, I mean, people who are still in but aren't really making noise. I guess my contention is like it is too early to say whether they are good candidates, because this process just hasn't been going on that long in a way where a lot of people are paying attention. And there's something about the fact that the winnowing is already happening that seems weird given that fact. Now, maybe they're all just bad candidates, but I think we're not used to
22 candidate fields.
No, I think there's a real problem there.
A six candidate field is often fairly formidable if you have six big names, or a three or four candidate field. I mean, it'll probably eventually get down to somewhere between two and four. That's usually how it goes, right? And in some ways, all the winnowing that's occurred is like an argument for the kind of political science theory that, hey, winnowing works. It's like the poli-sci hashtag.
Why do we value candidates who are senators now, or who have made their name in the national press? I mean, because Americans profess to be immensely frustrated with the United States Senate and the Congress in general. So in some ways, it's a little bit counterintuitive given what, right? Like, and I'm kind of curious I've sort of proffered the theory of, well, they're well-known names. There have been lots of high-profile, like, senatorial hearings. I think that's kind of how Harris made her name. She's a new senator, and she was prosecutorial in hearings. She became a thing. But it's also confounding in some way because, like, Buttigieg is the only candidate who is top-tier candidate who is operating in a way that Americans sort of say they want politicians to operate, right? Effective, local, like, you know, local executive, things like that, not a part of a stalling legislative body.
Could it also be because of the nationalization of politics, in the sense that whenever we're having a conversation about an issue that's taking place in Washington, that is all over cable news, mm-hmm. that is on the networks, the people who are weighing in are going to be people who are, you know, well, in Congress or in the Senate more specifically. And of course, people in the Senate have been elected by more people generally.
Right. So the Democratic field brought to you by TV.
In a way, right? I mean, how did all of these people maintain or boost their brands in the time between Donald Trump's election and when they announced?
So let's not neglect something here, which is that in 2010 and 2014, Democrats had really bad midterms, and 2010-2014 are when governors are elected. And so if you do not get very many governors elected who are new and fresh and in swing states, because you're losing all the swing states in wave years, then you don't have a lot of prospects. Whereas I'm sure in 4 years or 8 years, Gretchen Whitmer will be someone who is considered maybe an elite prospect governor of Michigan for the nomination. And other candidates elected in Midwestern swing states and Southern swing states, whatever else, right? But like the kind of people left over after those two really poor years, and that's, again, what you would expect. Someone will be in office for a term or a term and a half or 2 terms, then they might run for president, right? It's usually a typical pattern. And so the fact that you didn't have this kind of new crop emerge in this kind of rather long 8-year period of the Obama administration, now you do, but they're too new or too fresh or would undermine their brands by running, that's a big factor.
So this goes back to the critique of the Obama administration, which is that the state level party atrophied under his leadership.
Oh, and I think that's basically borne out in the data. Like, he lost about 1,000 state legislative seats during his tenure. But I want to get back to something that Micah seemed to suggest at the beginning, which is, it seems at this point like part of the reason that these candidates got out is because, one, they weren't going to make the September debates, and two, because they were interested in running for office back home where they came from. So does it seem like the DNC is potentially winnowing the field too soon by amping up the credentials to get into the debates?
So I think the answer to that is yes. I think the field is winnowing too early, and yet I'm not sure there's a better option given the size of the field.
Do you think the field should ever winnow?
No. There should be 24 presidents.
No, that's a serious question.
I think that...
You don't think you think they should all drop out of their own volition?
I think that I'd be more comfortable with people dropping out having gotten a good look from voters and the media. And maybe Swalwell got a good look. Maybe Moulton got a good look. Maybe Inslee got a good look.
I don't think Moulton or Swalwell deserve good looks.
But that's not an interesting conversation, right?
Like,
let's have
but it's like, wait, hold on. Okay, so like the...
Why? Everybody deserves a good look.
Because they take away from people who are more qualified and interesting, like a Jay Inslee, for example, or
okay,
like
so
a Booker
or
Klobuchar, or Gillibrand.
Yeah. Wait, but like the... Okay, if we think of like the Democratic field as a marketplace, then the DNC is the regulator of the marketplace, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they impose regulations, and some people decide that the market forces don't favor them, and so they drop out. I think it's a bit crippled. Like, there aren't a lot of incentives for if there were no debate qualifications to meet, I wonder how many people would have dropped out by September, October, November, December,
yeah,
whatever it was. And then would Americans, or Democrats specifically, be seeing an impoverished debate because there were so many people going on, so many couldn't get a good sense of the field? I don't know. I think it's a hard...
Wouldn't you rather hear from Amy Klobuchar or Julian Castro and hear twice as much from him instead of from like some generic white congressman,
yes,
who's been elected for 2 terms?
Yes, but I'm not criticizing the DNC, really.
No, like, I'm not. I think the winnowing is the best thing they've done.
The debate thresholds are like, even these higher ones for the September debate are like pretty freaking low, right?
I would like to take a moment here to say that they should not have a Friday night debate.
No,
it's,
okay.
Wait, no, but it's actually no,
the
no
ABC,
I mean,
News, ABC News debate.
I mean this seriously because I have a wedding that weekend, and also because people who get chosen for the Friday night debate. I mean, who's going to watch that? Truly.
No, I think like that's a legitimate concern. Let me just say.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. The point I'm trying to make, I guess, isn't, maybe it's not an interesting point, but it's that when you have a field this big, it kind of breaks the system.
Right.
And it's just like an inevitable product of a field this big is that you're going to have a whole set of candidates come and go without getting a good look.
Okay.
That's the only point I'm making.
So part of this conversation about whether the DNC is putting its thumb on the scale or forcing a winnowing process too early is predicated on the idea that the debates play a major role in who people end up supporting, right? Like, the idea is, well, if you're not going to make the debates, you might as well get out because you're not going to have a chance of, you know, raising your profile nationally and moving up in the polls. Is that true? Do people really, I mean, very well maybe, I just don't know. Do people make up their minds about who they want to support based on how they've seen them perform in the debates?
Well, I think it matters for like middle tier candidates looking to make an impression. I think it mattered for Castro, right? Like, was it the first debate?
Both debates.
But it probably mattered for Booker in a small way. I think people like to gauge how their candidate looks in a debate. But if among the top tier people, I'm not sure how much it like bolsters their support in the long term, right? Like, we've seen Biden go down a few points and then rise back up. I don't know.
Did Harris go up some points and then go back down?
Yeah. So I think it matters more for middle tier people. And I think we've said this in some of our live blogs of like, Klobuchar probably needed to have some sort of breakout moment in some debate in order to kind of make a viable sprint. Like, I don't think she's a candidate who's going to, among the people who are more quote unquote serious top tier people, I'd bet that Klobuchar is one of the people to drop out this fall if those people were going to drop out.
Unless she has a moment in debate.
Unless she has a moment in debate, yeah.
I think it matters much more than it used to. Because you used to have candidates like skip debates, and you'd have debates with like two of the candidates but not the other two, and then you know.
Well, it used to be up to the networks would just kind of cobble together debates with whoever would join.
And now with such a big field, I mean, there's not like I don't think there's an empirical answer to this really, because it kind of this era of like huge fields and like party sponsored debates, I think it is new enough, but like I do think the debates to a large extent define the race, and if you're not there, you're not there.
Previously, the Democratic Party and Republican Party has seen candidates who did not do particularly well early on in the polls go on to do well in Iowa or New Hampshire and raise their profile that way and either go on to be competitive or eventually win the nomination. In the case of Jimmy Carter, you obviously have to go pretty far back to get a case like that. Is that a good thing? Should the primary function in such a way where those kind of dark horse candidates can make a lot of noise in Iowa and go on to win? And if it is a good thing, is it bad that the DNC seems to be preventing that in some ways from happening?
I mean, I think all your questions are biased, Galen, because you're asking them in one side. You're like, did the DNC winnow too soon? Why might not they have winnowed too late?
Because,
I mean, historically, first of all,
it doesn't seem very late in the primary season.
In terms of strict self-interest for the parties, historically, these very large nomination processes tend to produce pretty chaotic results, mm-hmm. Which resulted in McGovern being nominated in 72, Jimmy Carter in 76, and Donald Trump in 2016 on the GOP side. And there aren't any nominations until this one that have been as broad as
that
before.
Well, I asked, is that a good thing? And your answer could have been, no, it's a bad thing. You don't want dark horse candidates going on to win the nomination because they don't well represent the parties. And that's a strong academic argument that's oftentimes made about our primary.
I'm not saying
Answer the question, sir!
I'm not saying anything against dark horse candidates. I'm saying that, like, there used to be kind of an implicit agreement where candidates wouldn't run these vanity campaigns as much and these hopeless campaigns as much. And now, because they think, oh, anything can happen because of Trump, now they do. And I think also because of like a lot of ego in the kind of digital era, right, where you can have your micro.
Ooh, that's an interesting theory, that we all feel more empowered because we have more grassroots ways of reaching people.
Yeah.
That Yang exists as a candidate because of the internet. I mean, he's the only sort of non-TV candidate, but
Yang,
right?
Yang in some ways is someone who is like a traditional dark horse
niche underdog candidate.
Yeah. Who is kind of the fun, you know, weird candidate that you have in the debate, right? And provides, I don't know, some combination of interesting and new ideas and comic relief or whatever you want to call it, right? Whereas it's like all the random, and we did a piece on this, right? All the people who are late, they're almost all like white guys, right? It's all this random parade of like white men who didn't really think through their campaign, de Blasio or something, right? Didn't really think through the campaign. I mean, de Blasio is actually more credentialed than some of them. Being mayor of New York is no small thing.
The argument on this podcast that we shouldn't have these kind of like paternalistic rules and the market should kind of take itself where it will. Why do you think that shouldn't be the case in the nominating process?
It is, and the market's clearly rejecting a lot of these candidates, and probably the market's rejecting more of the candidates
than
have dropped out so far.
I guess you could also make the point that the primary process is a private organization's way of selecting a leader. So while it may be lightly democratic, it's not entirely democratic.
What is like the ideal? Okay, well, let's say we're the DNC, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a field of, let's say, whatever, 24, 25 candidates. It's January 2019, what would our ideal winnowing pace be? Would it be like half are gone by Iowa, another half are gone by Super Tuesday, and then, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Sure. I think you want a lot to drop out by the fall.
Before Iowa.
Yeah. I think you want some of the, like, blah people who probably aren't real contenders to drop out, because then you have a better idea from the results or from polls who is a viable candidate.
I mean, I think maybe you need to put credentials or qualifications as part of the qualifying criteria.
See, I disagree with you on that. Why? Why should the DNC cut off the possibility that someone who is a dark horse candidate, who is not a person in national politics, who might be the outsider that Democrats mm-hmm. have been praying for, why should they cut themselves off to
they
that
aren't.
Possibility?
And we've seen two people, Pete Buttigieg and Andrew Yang, emerge to the point where they, despite not having traditional credentials at all, mayor of South Bend, entrepreneur, emerge as people who are actually quite popular and
so
have a big following.
So what are your criteria?
My criteria is that I think it should be easier for senators and governors to
survive.
No,
but you just said that there should be criteria that you have to meet. So what would that be?
That maybe, you know, you have a snout thing where you have an and, you have to both get 2% in four polls and meet this fundraising threshold. Maybe if you're a senator or governor, or former vice president, I suppose, then that becomes an or. And if you're not, then that's an and.
So there's like two tracks to get into the debate. It's like win some level of elected office or above, or show enough grassroots support.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I guess I still come back to this question of like, these large fields are a big problem.
I think, I mean, to go back to you criticizing me for being biased in how the primary process works, interestingly enough, I'm working on a project right now that gets at how the primary process works and the role that the parties can or should play. And there's a very strong argument for the party playing a much larger role in vetting candidates and winnowing, et cetera, et cetera. I mean,
yeah.
Up until 1972, there was very, very little role for voters, and it was almost entirely up to the parties. And a lot of academics today will make the argument that the party should play a larger role and that the nominating process has gotten out of hand and no longer functions as a way to find a candidate to represent party platforms who can eventually govern and work with the politicians who are already elected. There are all kinds of arguments. At the same time, if you're going to have an open process, then people are going to be critical of it when it's not as open as it can be.
No, but that's kind of what I'm getting at, is you kind of have the worst of both worlds right now, because you have a theoretically open process, but it's overrun enough by candidates that it impinges on the kind of small d democratic value of it being open, because there's not actually like all that much democratic decision making going on, small d, right? It's more just like who has a credential, who can get attention among like five national media outlets, and that's it.
Have we come to a conclusion here? No.
No.
I don't think so.
Like the DNC, we are telling listeners to make their own determination.
I mean,
one
conclusion is kind of that the public has decided there are somewhere between 4 to 8 candidates they really care about anyway, and so maybe it doesn't matter that much in the end what the party's rules are. If I were the DNC, I would want to facilitate a conversation between that larger group, at least that 8 to 10 group, the candidates who qualify for the debate so far, right? And I'm not super sympathetic to candidates who didn't make that threshold. I think the threshold's not that high. It's not low anymore, but it's not that high.
No, I agree.
2%.
I agree with that. And I do think there is like this top tier that's pretty distinct from the rest. I guess my question then is like, okay, if we're saying at this point, you know, it's August of 2019, that the public, the market, has drawn this line in the field, and everyone above it is a viable candidate, everyone below it, get out. Who has made that decision? Is it the Democratic electorate in a real way, like the full Democratic electorate, representative of the one that will come out and vote in November 2020? And if not, what are the skews?
Are you getting at that you think that people aren't paying enough attention yet, and therefore the people who are paying attention are a certain kind of person, and they are choosing these candidates unfairly for the rest of the population?
That, and you know, it's just like an imperfect mechanism.
But you could also say that those people who are paying attention to the race and who are winnowing the field for everyone else are doing what the party itself wants people to do, right? So they are democratically winnowing the party, right? The party elites aren't the ones who are setting standards and getting rid of them. It's the people who are already paying attention who are saying, these are not viable people, so get them the hell out, right? The idea that there are tiers of voter attention and the high interest voters are paying attention now and deciding these are bad candidates and good candidates. I agree that there's problems with that because it might be tilted toward certain demographics. But you can also, it's a little bit like wisdom of the crowds of like saying.
Yeah, maybe whatever its limitations, maybe that still is better than, you know, it being a smoke-filled room, right? It's like it's a biased population, but at least it's a population from the populace and not like a bunch of elites. Although Galen wants the elites to decide.
I was just accused by Nate of not wanting the elites to play any role. So now I don't know which position
Galen,
I actually
But I think we have to, I do think we have to agree that there's a certain amount of hubris going on with the number of people who are still left in the race, right?
Yeah.
Right, and I think that's
15 of them probably.
But also, that's not just the people left in the race. That's people who run for president.
I mean, in fairness.
Right, but hubris is like, it's a sort of like denigration of pridefulness, right? Why is Joe Sestak in the race if he doesn't actually have a chance of winning? It's because of excessive pride.
Is it excessive? So one other theory that we had is that people think that in this environment where the candidates who run for president get a lot of media attention, you have something to gain by running for president, whether or not you think you can win. I guess kind of looking at the people who aren't taking off but have decided to run for president, like the people who have dropped out and the people remaining like Joe Sestak or whatever that we've branded as having hubris, are those people gaining much? Are they gaining?
Of the people who haven't made the debate stage, who are still running for president, there actually aren't a lot who I think are. I mean, de Blasio, Bennett, Delaney, Gabbard, Gillibrand. I mean, Gillibrand's going to stay in the Senate. So is Bennett. I mean, maybe she'll run for governor of New York. I don't know. Maybe these people do have a higher office thing, but I kind of am like, well, they already were known by people in their state. Someone like Tim Ryan maybe has more of a competitive advantage by being like, I was just a relatively unknown congressman to lots of parts of the state, but then I ran for president and now maybe I'll run for governor or something like that. I don't know, but I think at this point it's a little bit like
people aren't gaining all that much from running if they're not
I think you risk the point where people start to get irritated at you for running for president.
No, and there's studies that show like, well, first of all, almost all the candidates have gone up in name recognition. Nathaniel Rakich has a piece coming out tomorrow that shows that. So, you know, they do gain something. But there are studies that show that historically, at least, one of the variables that predicts whether you'll drop out is how kind of close are you to the party. And I think that's the reason why, what Claire just said, which is if you, like, kind of care about your standing in the party, then remaining in the race far beyond where you're viable damages those ties. But if you're someone, you know, who's like a classic example of someone.
I mean, like Marianne Williamson may stay until July.
Yeah, because why does she give a shit, right? If like, you know, Chuck Schumer is unhappy with her, you know.
All right. Well, I think we should wrap this segment because we have lots more to talk about. But it has been fun, heated conversation.
Fighting about primary systems is super fun.
It's the most 538-y thing you can do.
That's why Galen is running. Also, hubris aside, Claire and I did sort of seriously talk about launching a Micah Cohen bid for the New York mayoral seat. So
that's true. A couple of years.
So maybe
that sounds like the beginning of some movie where you do it as a journalistic exercise, and then Micah accidentally becomes the mayor of New York, and that's just the world we all have to live in.
I'd watch that movie. We were going to do it as a way to cover the anyway.
And then starts going to Iowa randomly, even though he's still mayor and abandoning his city. And not to accuse the current mayor.
Oh wow, that was coming out swinging. Okay. Let's talk about the economy and President Trump's standing, but first, today's podcast is brought to you by Honey. Have you ever bought something online only to find out later that you missed a discount? Well, you don't have to overspend anymore thanks to Honey. Honey is a free browser add-on that finds the best deals online, and the app magically auto-applies the best deal to your cart at checkout. Honey finds discounts and coupons across 37,000 sites, Amazon, Sephora, Best Buy, Nordstrom, and more. With Honey, you don't have to worry about missing a deal. Just shop like normal, and Honey handles the rest. Honey has saved its 10 million members an average of $28.61. Honey has over 100,000 five-star reviews on the Google Chrome store, and Time Magazine calls Honey basically free money. Look, there's really no reason not to try Honey. It's free to use and easy to install on your computer in just two clicks. So shop with confidence. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/538. That's joinhoney.com/538. The numbers, not the letters. Honey, the smart shopping assistant that saves you time and money when you're shopping online. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Lightstream. Credit card bills. Every month you get them. With multiple payments and multiple due dates, wouldn't it be easier to just have one payment at a lower rate? You can with a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream. Get a rate as low as 5.95% APR with autopay. That's lower than the average credit card interest rate of over 19% APR. Plus, the rate is fixed, so it will never go up over the life of the loan. You can get a loan from $5,000 to $100,000 with no fees. And you can even get your money as soon as the day you apply. The online application is so easy, you can apply right from your phone. Lightstream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience, and that's exactly what they deliver. Apply now to get a special interest rate discount. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/538. That's lightstream.com/538. Subject to credit approval, rate includes 0.5% autopay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/538 for more information. We're back, and recently, economists and economic institutions have noted an increase in the likelihood of a recession in the coming year or so. Some indicators point in that direction, but others don't. And we also know that economists are famously bad at predicting recessions. We ourselves are also not recession forecasters, so we're not going to debate the likelihood of a recession.
I don't know. Nate went to University of Chicago.
My freaking degree was in economics, dude.
Would you like to predict a recession?
I would like to remind people that economists are unable to predict recessions more than 6 to 9 months in advance, and so therefore this whole segment should be treated with the big caveat.
Right. So we're going to just engage in the hypothetical, right? If a recession were to happen, how might it affect American politics and in particular Trump's standing? So we're going to look at history and also consider why things might be different in our current political era. But Nate, as you mentioned, you studied economics at the University of Chicago. You've also written plenty about this. So start us off. What do we know about the effects of a worsening economy historically on a president's chance of being reelected?
It's bad.
And what
wow.
are
Nate's
what
parents are, paid hundreds of thousands of dollars for him to come to that conclusion.
And what are the most important indicators and how significant are they? Like, it's bad, but how bad?
So there is,
what matters?
Actually, I have done a lot of work on this problem.
Actually?
Actually?
It's like, actually, this is something I'm not just going to bullshit about.
Everyone ate their Wheaties this morning.
So first of all, you should not look at any one magic economic indicator. You should look at the entire basket, the bouquet,
the cornucopia
of economic indicators that affect people in different ways. So you look at jobs, look at GDP, you can look at the stock market, you can look at inflation, you can look at there are some metrics that are less
the inverted
measurable
yield curve.
Well, the yield curve is a evaluation of investor expectations at various time horizons. There's stuff like industrial production that tends to be predictive of recessions, but like you might not notice as much unless you work in that industry. But yeah, the economy is not a simple thing, never has been a simple thing. Americans experience it differently. Look at income. And so a kind of broad cornucopia of measures what you should look at. But what we know is that when you have enough of those measures, and by the way, the way recessions are defined is based on a consensus of indicators showing negative growth. It's not actually just GDP, at least not in the U.S. It's a bureau decides when recessions begin and end, and they look at four major measures. So a recession means a broad-based downturn in the economy that persists for more than one quarter, that persists for 6 months or more. And when you've had recessions, it's very hard for presidents to be reelected. 2008 was the last time you had a recession, very bad for the GOP. Bush might have lost for other reasons, but McCain, rather, in Bush's stead, lost badly to Obama. The last actual incumbent president to face reelection in a recession year was 1980. Did not go really well for Jimmy Carter. People remember Bush in 1992 being another case of that. This is kind of a funny thing. The National Bureau, NBER, did not declare the recession of 1990 over until after the election in 1992. So people,
even
thought,
though it was already over and they were growing it over 3%
for a long time. We could be in a recession right now, man.
Okay, is there a way to measure how big the impact is relative to how bad or how good the economy is? Like, can you draw some kind of relation?
We build our models based on how economic stats are reported in real time, right? So it's not the revised number. By the way, there's just a revision that cut a bunch of jobs that we thought we had that apparently don't have, right? There are measurement issues and timing issues and revision issues. We build our models based on what numbers were reported at the time, and those still show plenty of relationship between the economy and re-election. Now, we could take it from the other direction where there are some fundamentals models that go too far and say, oh, it's purely determined by the economy. And I think it's not. I think the economy is, like, to put a number on it, is maybe 40% of what drives a president's reelection odds. The problem for Trump is that, like, I don't think the other 60% is going super duper well. He's not very popular, despite up until now having had very positive sentiment, and not just sentiment, but actual numbers about the economy. I mean, job growth has been great. So if that 40% starts to turn sour for him, then that becomes difficult.
Okay, but looking at this from the other direction, right, he's remained at only in the low 40s in approval while we've had pretty good economic numbers, meaning that perhaps people aren't saying they're looking at other things and they're prioritizing other parts of their partisan identity as opposed to saying, hey, the economy is good. I like this president. So is there also an argument that would say that if the economy sours, the 40% that's remained with him has strong partisan feelings and will not part ways with him because they're with him whether or not the economy is doing well?
I don't have proof of it, but I think you do see people in certain industries, I would say industries that are affected by the tariffs. So people in, let's say, like large scale agriculture or family farms or whatever you want to say, things that are affected by Trump's tariffs. A lot of those people might support Trump themselves. And anecdotally, I've heard from reporting and that people are still sort of sticking with him, that they say this might be bad for me on a small scale, but on the large scale, it's good for the United States. Therefore, I support Trump's tariffs. And by the way, I think I should mention, like, I think Trump's team would say that the whole conversation surrounding is there going to be a recession is like this biased conversation, right? It's sort of an interesting, like, Trump's rapid response person. I posted this tweet in our Slack. He posted screenshots from MSNBC and, you know, the chyrons that say, is there a recession? Would it be bad for Trump? They would say that this news cycle is biased in and of itself. I mean, economic indicators.
Which
aside.
It is. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, like, liberal commentators are going to latch on anything they think right. will lower Trump's odds, right? At the same time, I'm old enough to remember 2012, where the biggest event of every month in the re-election campaign report for Obama was the jobs report. And that was, like, a huge deal.
But given the uncertainty that you've written about, Nate, and Amelia had a piece for the site about the other day, given just the uncertainty about predicting a recession, which is to say there's a ton of uncertainty, I do think there's been an overemphasis on the possibility of a recession, particularly from liberal outlets, right? Which it's maybe not surprising.
Oh, I disagree. I think, setting somewhat aside that the long-term forecasting record is not great.
Why do you disagree?
Because it's so much more important than all the other bullshit people talk about day to day, right? Like, Trump talking about buying Greenland is, like, you know, occupies as many news cycles as a recession and matters. I think it's kind of amusing. I would like to buy Greenland.
That's a straw man argument.
There's a strong geopolitical argument for buying Greenland.
Yeah.
I think the economy matters more than the Mueller report to Trump's re-election chances, perhaps.
In terms of re-election chances or in terms of just the priorities for the country, period?
Re-election chances.
Maybe both. Whether a recession is something is probably more important than some head-to-head poll of Trump versus Biden, which doesn't mean anything at this stage.
It's more important than a bunch of, like, really stupid stories. Mm. But I still think it's been, you know, I think, as you said, the left is, like, latching onto it as a thing. I guess my question, though, is, like, well, this is Galen's question, but there's a question of how the economy affects a president's reelection chances. So there's, like, what Claire mentioned of, like, how does the president's policies just sort of, like, impact my day-to-day life? If I'm a farmer in Iowa, maybe the tariffs are hurting me, right? Or Trump's other policies are hurting me. I do think, though, that the kind of increase in polarization, the increase in negative partisanship will, outside of a large shock, temper the economy's effect on the election.
the partisanship is too strong now for anything but partisanship to be the guiding force in how people make decisions about politics.
No, I still think it'll be an effect. I just think it'll temper it. So whatever the effect was before, I think it'll be less.
What voters do we think will be the ones to base their decisions most strongly on economic indicators or the economy as a whole?
Swing voters. I mean, it's always a little unclear in the literature whether it's actually how the economy affects you directly. Clearly, if you lose your job, you're probably more pissed off about stuff and are more favorable toward change. I mean, look, there are a couple of theories here. The theory that I would put the majority of my eggs in is maybe Micah's theory, which is that everything in Trump, things do move the numbers. The shutdown moved the numbers, for example. The Comey firing moved the numbers. But things are dampened maybe half or less of what they have been historically. That's one, I think, very sound theory. But by the way, Trump's already pretty tenuous at 41% or 42%. And so if you lose even 2 points, then it becomes really hard. A second theory is that the economy is very important to Trump's brand. And that the economy kind of allows people to forgive a lot of behavior that's not traditional from a president. And so, you know, that might begin to dry up. And then what if the rug comes out from under him?
I mean, that's the argument that we've made oftentimes when people always ask the question of, well, why isn't such and such thing affecting Trump in the polls? Well, we say, you know, all of those things already are affecting him, but the economy is keeping him in the low 40s. So yeah, that's kind of a theory that we've relied on a lot in analysis.
Well, and to Claire's question of like which voters in particular, if that theory is right, then you would think that kind of the Obama-Trump voter, the suburban college-educated woman who traditionally has voted Republican, all these groups that had an unfavorable view of Clinton and Trump in 2016 and voted for Trump, that if you remove the economy, then it's just like the bottom falls out and they all kind of go to the Democratic column.
I put more of my weight, like I said, on the first theory. And they could also be tugging in different directions, right? Where you end up, I mean, look, if I had to bet, then and we have some models showing kind of here's a shift in the economy and here's in their access to shifting approval ratings, I would bet that Trump's will be less than it has been historically. But I think there's a range there. And, you know, it's also like the maybe it's too late for it to matter for Trump. But like a lot of these channels where like people who are rich businessmen who donate a lot of money to the president's reelection campaign and can influence the discourse in various ways. Right. If they feel like, number one, their economic fortunes are not that good. Number two, it's partly because of decisions that Trump is undertaking with respect to China. And again, we should always say, I mean, Trump is not the most consistent guy. We're taping this at a time when he's been at the G7 and sounding more conciliatory noises toward China, as well as other partners of the United States. And so Trump might kind of wind up reading the writing on the wall and taking phone calls from all these old rich dudes who are like, hey, Trump, cool it with the China stuff. It's bad for our business. And seeing the stock market go down and his polls go down, whatever else, and might correct that. But I don't know. Trump has always had an argument that like, hey, look, whatever they say about me at the end of the day, right?
The economy is great.
In peacetime, sort of, and the economy is good and we've grown jobs, right? And again, Trump's base doesn't necessarily need to hear the argument. Trump's base will gravitate toward the immigration, xenophobia, and whatever else, right? But like Trump's base alone is not all that large. It's not large enough for him to win re-election, even with his advantage in the Electoral College. So therefore, he needs some swing voters to win. And I think one non-trivial group of swing voters is people who are like, yeah, maybe Trump's. I mean, you hear this from people. They'll literally say, yeah, Trump's a little racist, but he's good for the economy and the media overblows it. Right. That's not the average or median voter, but like that's a type of
swing
voter.
You've literally heard people say that?
Yes.
That aside, to back up some of this idea that partisanship does temper how people view Trump in relation to the economy, Amy Walter at the Cook Political Report,
Friend of the show,
actually looked at this and looked at some research from the University of Michigan survey of consumers. And a partisan gap in terms of economic optimism is very common. Going back to Reagan, you see a partisan gap. But the partisan gap has grown exponentially almost under Trump. So in terms of differences in how Democrats and Republicans view the economy, the partisan gap under Reagan was 19, under Bush, 21, under Obama, 24, and under Trump now 55. Basically, even though economic indicators have been good and consumers have been pretty optimistic, Democrats are just like, no, we don't see the economy as being very good. So that kind of adds to this idea that the level of partisanship could temper how people view Trump in relation to the economy going forward.
I also think parties place different emphasis on parts of the economy, right? So Democrats have a big focus on the gig economy and the minimum wage, right? So the idea that while we might have robust employment, what kind of jobs are those people getting? What sort of lifestyle are they affording people? And I also think you saw in 2016 people's irritation at Obama or the Democratic administration for kind of overlooking regional economic problems, right? The idea that you'd talk to people in West Virginia and they'd say, well, people kind of, yes, you know, people are voting for Trump because he said he wants to bring back coal. Maybe that isn't realistic. But what he got was there was a certain overlooking of states or geographic areas or kinds of workers, and solutions weren't sort of readily proffered. So the idea that people also perceive the economy very differently based on region.
No, and also, I think that's right. And also, how much of it is just totally disconnected from the actual economy and just pure partisanship, right? To be clear, I think both are true. But, you know, the second Trump was elected, not even inaugurated, I think before he was inaugurated, sort of Republican views of the economy, like, skyrocketed, right?
Oh, yeah. You look at the Pew data, and it was basically went from, like, the percent of people who saw economic conditions as excellent or good was like in the 20s. And then by the time he was inaugurated or early on in his administration, it had gone up to like the 70s.
No, and Democrats, right, are kind of no less guilty, right? They're the opposite. But I guess I do think that if there was like another great recession, it would break the partisan blinders, at least for a lot of people. I don't feel like it's like, okay, in this era of increased partisanship, now nothing matters. If there were like a huge crash, I would imagine that a lot of like Republicans would be unhappy with Trump.
I mean, if they were like a 2007 style crisis, then yeah. Look, partisanship dampens everything, but also makes your margins much more tenuous, right? So in some sense, the fact that like Trump is in very narrow shape, I don't know if he's on track to win re-election anyway. Maybe not, right? Probably not, frankly. If you look at the polls right now, today.
You heard it here first, folks.
Prediction.
No, I'm kidding.
But so, like, right now he's at 42%, and right now again, these polls are not predictive, but it is, like, literally true that, like, he's not on track today to win re-election in the sense that, like, if he had the election today, he wouldn't have had his campaign yet, right? Probably would lose.
okay. All right.
But,
well,
yeah. But like Michael was saying, there are two things about the economy. Number one, people do experience some effects of the economy firsthand. If you lose your job, then you can blame whoever you want for that, but you lose your job. It's real. It's not fake news.
I would blame you, Nate.
Okay. Well, in your case, yeah. Secondly, Trump has a slightly more tactical dilemma, which is that measures that you would take to ameliorate the economy require you to sort of admit that the economy is maybe struggling. To pass a big payroll tax cut, for example, which I don't think Pelosi would do anyway, but like it's kind of saying, hey, we need economic stimulus. Well, why do you need stimulus? Well, maybe the economy is not doing so well. If you want a rate cut, that kind of requires acknowledging there are risks to the outlook ahead. Therefore, that can create some friction as well.
And you can also try to offload blame to other things, as Donald Trump has already been doing, which is like the media and Democrats and the Fed, et cetera, et cetera. We will see how this all plays out. We're going to wrap for now, but I think it's been, we had some
feisty.
good feisty conversations today. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Micah.
Thanks.
And before we go, as usual, go check us out on ABC News Live. If you want to see the feistiness in action, you can check us out on Tuesday in the afternoon, or look at our YouTube channel later in the day as well, and you'll be able to see us. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store, or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.